Molly Sanderson, Session 13, May 28, 2013. Audio transcription. Session recorded with patient knowledge and consent. Why don't we ever talk about the baby? We talk about everything else. My job, Ella, Justin, my mother, who's been dead for almost 20 years. You don't think she's relevant? No, I don't. I'm afraid I'll turn into her, of course. But other than that, no, I don't think she's relevant. Turn into her how? She was destroyed because my father left her. And because she was destroyed, she was a terrible mother. Do you think you're destroyed? That you'll end up a terrible mother? End up? It's already happened. I've been a terrible mother for months. I have to get over this. I have to get better. Or yes, I'll end up just like my mother. I can live with almost anything but that. So how am I going to get over it? I think we need to address your guilt. The baby was inside me. Of course I feel guilty. What was happening in the days before you found out the baby's heart had stopped? The days before? I don't know. I don't remember much. What difference does it make? The fact that you can't remember suggests to me that it might matter very much. The usual things. I was finishing a draft of a piece of proposed legislation before maternity leave. And we were trying to potty train Ella, and she kept peeing on the carpet, which sounds funny now, but it wasn't funny then. All I kept thinking was that we were going to have to get the carpets cleaned before Justin's family came to see the baby. And what about Justin? Was he busy too? So busy. He'd taken over a class for a colleague, and he was presenting two different papers at two different conferences in the 3 weeks before the baby was due. We were both really busy. That's life, right? Everybody's busy. I've never heard you be frustrated by that. That Justin was busy? After how much he's given up to take care of us since, how could I possibly be irritated by that? Besides, I was the one carrying the baby. And so he bears no responsibility. He has responsibilities, yes? He helped with Ella afterward and before, too, but he was working all hours. That wasn't his fault. He had a job to do. You seem very frustrated now, though. I am frustrated. With you. Listen, our problem wasn't who folded more laundry or unloaded the dishwasher or who last took out the garbage. Our baby is dead. That's our problem.
Jenna. May 28th, 1994. It finally happened. The captain and I had sex. I'd call it making love if that wasn't so gross, but that's what it felt like. Love. Everything about it was so perfect. His parents were away, so we had the house to ourselves, and I lied and told my parents that I was staying at Tiff's house, and it worked like a charm. For once, they didn't even call Tiff's mom to check. Otherwise, they would have found out that her family was away at a wedding in Philadelphia. The captain actually cooked dinner for me first. Like, he was my husband or something. It was some kind of spaghetti that was kind of gross, but I never tasted anything better in my whole entire life. And it was amazing. Didn't hurt at all, like Tiffany said it would. The captain was so sweet and gentle, and he didn't even know it was my first time. I didn't want him to be freaked out, and anyway, it's not like it's that big of a deal. I've done a lot of other stuff with a lot of other guys. He didn't tell me he loved me afterward. I wouldn't have wanted him to. It was so much better when he just held me like he did.
Sandy. At least there weren't any cars in the driveway when Sandy got to Hannah's house. Her heart was still beating hard, though, as she jumped off her bike. Sandy never would have gone to Hannah's if she'd had any choice. After making it out of the chief of police's office, the last place she wanted to go was his house. But it was the way Hannah had sounded on the phone when she'd given up on texting and started to call Sandy. Like she was sliding down to the bottom of a well. Sandy had thought, this is it. This is the end. The whole time Hannah had been a house of cards, and finally, those motherfuckers had started to slide. Maybe right into the hands of the chief of police. He'd been nice enough to Sandy, had said he would look for Jenna and all that. But there was something about the way he acted after Sandy said Jenna's name. Like it had changed everything for him. For sure, Hannah's dad at least knew of Jenna, had heard her name before. Maybe that could be a good thing, but Sandy sure as hell wanted to get in and out of his house before it turned into a bad one. "I'm so glad you're here," Hannah said when she opened the door. She gave Sandy a teary, worried smile, then pulled her into a tight hug as she dragged her inside. "It's so good to see you. I've been really worried." "But you really don't have to worry," Sandy said, even though she already knew there was no point. Nothing, she said, was going to get them out of this whack-ass country they'd gotten lost in. "I'm all right, I promise." "Do you want a drink or anything?" Hannah asked, leading Sandy toward the kitchen. "God, you look tired. Did you ever end up seeing a doctor?" Barely in the door, and there Hannah went. Sandy had been hoping Hannah wasn't going to do this, make them have this conversation face to face. Seems stupid now, but Sandy had actually thought she and Hannah would never talk to each other again after that night. That Sandy would never have to talk to anyone about what happened. And after a while, a long time even, it would be like it hadn't. Looking now at Hannah's worried face, Sandy could see just how wrong she'd been. "I'm all good," Sandy said. "Like I said a bunch of times, totally fine." The truth was she felt like crap. She hadn't slept in 2 days, and she didn't think she'd ever be hungry again. "Sorry to drag you over here," Hannah said, "but I have to watch my brother. He hasn't been... he's not feeling well. He's okay right now, but my mom had to go out and, well, I didn't know when I was going to get the chance to get out again." "Listen, can we go upstairs? Just in case your parents come home, I don't want to be sitting here right near the front door." Really, it was that Sandy could hear the TV in the other room, where Hannah's little brother must have been. And it was giving her bad flashbacks. "Sure, come on," Hannah said, smiling as they headed for the steps like she was 8 and Sandy was there for a sleepover. "We'll go to my room." It wasn't the first time Sandy had felt like a little girl around Hannah. It was part of why Sandy had liked hanging out with her. She felt like a regular kid when they were together, gossiping about stupid, regular shit. "You've never had a boyfriend? Ever?" Sandy had asked during one of their last tutoring sessions. She'd been telling Hannah about Aiden, which felt dumb. It wasn't like he was her boyfriend. "How's that possible? You're what, 17? And look at you. I don't believe you." It wasn't like she and Hannah had known each other long, but lately they'd been talking about all sorts of stuff that had nothing to do with Sandy's coursework. Hannah had suggested it the first time. You know, if Sandy wanted to hang out after. And it was nice, Hannah wanting to do that, because it wasn't like she was hard up for friends or something. Unless what Hannah wanted was a friend as messed up as Sandy, to feel good about herself by comparison. But Sandy could live with that. Everybody needed something. "What do you mean you don't believe me?" Hannah had laughed a little. "I'm serious. No boyfriend, ever. It's true." "Fine, whatever, but for the record, I don't believe you." Sandy had waved a pencil in Hannah's face. "You're too pretty and nice and smart. Wait, are you gay?" That felt like it might explain a lot. I mean, I don't give a shit, but in this particular situation, I think that would count as lying. Girlfriend, boyfriend, same thing. I like boys, Hannah had said with a shrug. But it's complicated. They're not worth the trouble right now. Maybe you've been with the wrong guys. Usually it's the ladies who overcomplicate shit. But maybe Sandy was the one getting things wrong. When guys really wanted you, all of you, it probably was a shitload messier. Maybe Sandy's relationship with boys had always been simple because they weren't relationships at all. Guys wanted one thing from Sandy. Sex. And she knew after a lifetime of watching Jenna that it was stupid to give it up to them as easily as she did. But for some reason, it had always felt more stupid to snap on a chastity belt. Only an idiot would think doing that would change the way things were going to turn out for her. I'm not saying the guys are complicated, Hannah rolled her eyes. It's a bunch of other things. My mom, for one. If you think she's uptight about glitter shoes, imagine what she'd be like about boys. Anyway, it's not just her. I think maybe I want to save myself until marriage. And don't bother making fun of me. I already know you'll probably think that's fucked up or whatever. Hannah always sounded so weird swearing, like she didn't know what the words meant. Sandy shrugged. Is that what you want? To wait until you're married? And I mean you, not your mom. Hannah looked up then. Yes, she said quietly. It is what I want. When I'm with someone, finally, I want it to be someone who likes me for me, you know? All the boys I know, usually, it feels like all they care about is themselves. What the hell did Sandy know? That was probably exactly what Hannah should do, wait for someone more mature. It was probably exactly what Sandy should have done. If that's what you want, Sandy said, then there's nothing fucked up about it. I can't tell you how good it is to see that you're okay, Hannah said again once they were upstairs. She motioned for Sandy to sit on the bed while she pulled out the desk chair and turned it around. Hannah did look relieved now, happy almost. I mean, you look tired, like I said, but I was picturing, I don't know, worse. Sandy needed to pull the trigger, end this in a way that hopefully wouldn't make Hannah freak. Then Sandy needed to back the fuck out of this mess, slow and steady. No big movements. Yeah, Sandy said. So, listen, I'm glad I came too, because I needed to tell you that I'm going out of town. I might be pretty hard to reach for a while. Not moving out of Ridgedale, though, that would be too much. Just a trip, an excuse for Sandy to be out of touch. People like Hannah went out of town all the time. Long weekend, summer vacation. It was a regular thing they did. Oh? Hannah looked worried. She rocked her hips back and forth, tucking her hands beneath her thighs. Where are you going? Crap. Sandy hadn't worked that out. That was another thing people like Hannah did. They planned an actual place to go instead of driving around randomly, like the last time she and Jenna had gone on vacation and ended up at a Courtyard Marriott in Camden. Washington, D.C., Sandy said, first place that jumped to mind. And it was somewhere regular people went. For a few weeks, maybe a month. A month? Hannah blinked at her. That's such a long time. Shit, it was. Sandy shouldn't have said a month. She should have started small, hoped for the best. But what did any of this matter? A week, a month? At the end of the day, Sandy wouldn't be able to control what Hannah said or who she said it to once she was gone. All the more reason for Sandy to go for real, to go far, and to go forever. But for that, she'd need Jenna. Yeah, it's kind of a long time, Sandy said. But my mom wants to stay for a while, so won't you have your phone? Shit, why hadn't she thought of that either? My mom won't let me bring it. She wants to, you know, unplug. Oh, okay, Hannah said. She seemed satisfied. Only she with that mother of hers, would believe that bullshit. Well, thanks for coming over. I needed to actually see you to know that you were okay. I couldn't sleep thinking about it. Also, I wanted to make sure that you don't blame yourself. Because it was an accident, the whole thing. Sandy nodded, afraid of saying the wrong thing when she was so close to getting out the door. Yeah, I mean, no, definitely don't blame myself. Thanks for checking. But I do kind of have to go now. My mom will be waiting for me. Can I just use your bathroom before I take off? She wanted to splash water on her face, wash her hands. She'd been on her bike for hours. Yeah, sure, of course. It's right down the hall on the left. Sandy stared at her reflection in the bathroom mirror. Hannah was right. She did look like shit. But it wasn't like she was going to start looking better anytime soon. When she made it home to their empty apartment, she'd never be able to sleep. The medicine cabinet caught Sandy's eye then. Maybe there was a chance she could feel better for a while, or maybe she could just forget a little bit. At this point, she'd settle for that. For temporary. Seemed about fucking time Sandy cut herself a break. And yeah, it would be better if it wasn't the chief of police's medicine cabinet she was about to swipe some bottles from. But it wasn't like he'd know she'd been there. Besides, maybe Aiden had the right idea all along. Maybe what she needed was a bigger fuck-it bucket. Sandy opened the medicine cabinet. There were more than half a dozen little amber bottles with all sorts of different names. There had to be something in there that would work. That would wipe out the world. She grabbed a couple of the older bottles from the way back. One of Barbara's, one of Steve's. Faded, nearly expired, less likely to be missed. That had the telltale danger-controlled substance, illegal to dispense without prescription. Tranquilizers, painkillers, what difference did it make? One of them was bound to do the trick. Sandy shook the bottles and something rattled inside. Not now, though. Not yet. Only if she really couldn't fucking take it anymore. The looking for Jenna. The remembering. Sandy shoved the bottles in her pockets. She was pulling her shirt down over the lump in her jeans when there was a soft knock on the door. You should go now, Sandy. Out the back door. Hannah whispered from the other side. My brother just woke up and he's really upset. My mom's on her way home. Sandy saw the notice. Bright yellow and taped across her apartment door as she was coming up the steps of Ridgedale Commons. Even from that distance, she could see the padlock, too. The guy had said 24 hours. He'd probably even given her an extra few. Shit. Sandy stopped and leaned against the wrought iron railing, feeling her throat squeeze tight. She just couldn't keep it all in anymore. Couldn't take one more goddamn thing. Shit! She yelled it so loud that her throat vibrated as she slid down the wall. She curled up on the ground, arms wrapped tight around her knees, mouth pressed against them, and then she started to bawl. Once she'd started, it was like she was never going to stop. Her body shook, and she couldn't catch her breath. Her face was a snotty mess. She jammed her lips harder against her knees until she felt like her mouth might tear. She wanted it to. Sandy was still crying when she heard Mrs. Wilson's door open. A second later, she heard the old lady come out. Felt her staring down. Fuck. Good Lord, her neighbor said. What in heaven are you doing? Perfect. Exactly what Sandy needed. To have Mrs. Wilson rip into her. Sandy shouldn't have yelled. Not right outside Mrs. Wilson's door. She knew better. Sandy tried wiping her eyes, hoping it would help her stop crying. But that only made it worse. She felt like she was melting beneath her fingertips, like her tears were washing away her skin. Such a goddamn mess, all of this, all the time. Mrs. Wilson muttered, coming closer. Sandy could see the old woman's wiry, bare feet, her toes painted a bright orange. She wondered for a second what it would feel like when Mrs. Wilson kicked her. She braced herself for it. When the pain didn't come, Sandy looked up. Mrs. Wilson was standing there in a teenager's pink sweatsuit, her eyes shiny brown marbles in her bony, old lady face. She had a hand on her hip and a look of disgust on her face. "You hurt or something?" she shouted, like the problem with Sandy's hearing. "One of these bastards do something to you?" Sandy shook her head. But Mrs. Wilson looked up and down the walkway as if trying to find someone to blame. Then her eyes set on Sandy's front door. She turned her orange-polished toes in the direction of the door, then patted down for closer inspection. She lifted her pointy chin to squint at the ugly yellow sticker, then poked her nose in close to the padlock that was bolting shut the door. Mrs. Wilson marched back toward her own apartment, muttering more angrily as she disappeared inside. Sandy waited for her to slam the door. Instead, Mrs. Wilson reappeared, a crowbar gripped in her hand. Hoisting it against her hip, Mrs. Wilson headed to the apartment on the far side of hers. Every step looked like it might topple her skinny body. She rested the crowbar on the ground before pounding on her far neighbor's door. Two young guys lived there. Shady for sure, but not dealers, as far as Sandy knew. Otherwise, Jenna would have found her way over there a long time ago. Stolen electronics, maybe, or counterfeit something or other. From the constant stream of people in and out of their door, they were definitely selling something. "Hey, I know you're in there," Mrs. Wilson shouted when they didn't answer right away. She banged harder this time with her whole forearm. "I just heard your TV through my wall. Open up the damn door." A second later, the one with the scruff of hair on his chin filled the entryway. He was wearing a 76ers jersey and a baseball cap backward over a tangled brown ponytail. There was a gold chain on his right wrist. The guy didn't say anything, just stared at Mrs. Wilson like a startled elephant. Not angry, only confused. "Here." She shoved the crowbar at him. He blinked down at it, but didn't take it. "Go on," she scolded. "What are you waiting for?" Finally, he reached forward. In his big fingers, the crowbar became a weightless matchstick. He stared down at it, surprised and even more confused. "Now," Mrs. Wilson said, "you take that and go open that door." "What?" His voice was nicer, more polite than Sandy would have expected. "You heard me. Go open that door for this girl." Mrs. Wilson hooked a thumb toward Sandy's apartment. "It's locked." "What?" Now he sounded like a whiny teenager.
"Why?"
"Because I said so," she snapped, crossing her arms. "You boys are lucky someone hasn't called the police on you. And someone still could."
The guy heaved a loud sigh and lugged himself out of his apartment. As he headed for Sandy's door, he tossed the crowbar higher in his huge hand. He paused at Sandy's door to read the notice, turning back to look at Mrs. Wilson.
"Oh, please, don't act like you care about the law." She flapped a hand at him. "Just do it."
He looked over his shoulder once more to see if anyone was watching, something he'd definitely done 100 times before when breaking in elsewhere, then snapped the lock off in one easy movement. It fell to the ground with a thud. He walked back toward them, eyes on the ground. He rested the crowbar against the wall next to Mrs. Wilson and disappeared inside his apartment without saying another word.
Sandy pushed herself to her feet, heart pounding. She had to get in and out of that apartment now. Who knew what would happen when you broke open a lock like that? They arrested you, probably, and Sandy seriously did not fucking need that. Thank you, she said to Mrs. Wilson, her voice still hoarse from crying. Mrs. Wilson shook her head and stepped closer to Sandy, looking her hard in the eye.
You get in there and take what you need, she said. But then you go, because you are the only person in this world who's going to take care of you. The sooner you realize that, the better off you'll be.
Inside the apartment, Sandy moved fast. She grabbed a couple of the boxes they'd used to move in months earlier, then went around scooping up their personal crap that mattered. Jenna's jewelry box, Sandy's grandparents' pictures, her school records. She opened and closed cabinets, eyes darting around for anything important. There wasn't much. Their stuff that mattered barely filled a single box. Sandy filled a second box with some basic kitchen crap, a couple plates, some bowls, and a handful of silverware. She also grabbed the stuff Hannah had given her that night for safekeeping. She couldn't imagine ever seeing Hannah again. She hoped to God not. But it felt wrong to leave it behind. Sandy couldn't take much else. They'd just have to replace the rest of their cheap shit with new cheap shit. As it was, she didn't know where the hell she was going to put these two boxes. It wasn't like she could ride away with them on her bike. They'd need some clothes, too, an outfit for each, and she'd have to go with spring because there wasn't time to cover winter. It wasn't until then that Sandy noticed Jenna's coat hanging on the back of the door. It had been cold the night before last, frost on the grass in the morning. What if Jenna was outside somewhere? What if she'd frozen to death? Sandy tried to shake off the thought as she went back to Jenna's room for one last pass. Though she was trying not to hope that she'd find her money somewhere, she was still disappointed when she didn't. There was one last place Sandy could look, the place girls like Jenna always hid their secret stash. Sandy grabbed the mattress with two hands and pushed. She was almost glad when it pitched to the left and crashed against Jenna's bureau, taking everything on top, cheap bottles of perfume and small glass tchotchkes, down with it. When Sandy looked back, she couldn't believe it. But there was something fucking there on the box spring. Not her money. She'd never be that lucky. It was a small black book. Sandy picked it up, bracing herself when she flipped it open. Sure enough, there were her mom's bubbly, girly letters and a date on the first page. February 15th, 1994. Shit. Sandy tucked the two boxes under the building's stairs in a dusty, cobwebbed corner she was pretty sure no one would check. In her backpack, she'd shoved what was left of her cash, $18 now, Jenna's journal, a couple clean pairs of underwear, two t-shirts, and her toothbrush. She didn't know where the hell she was going to stay, but it wasn't here, that was for sure. The last thing Sandy was about to drop in the bag were the pills she'd stolen from Hannah's house. She would take them only if she got desperate, and then she'd take one pill, maybe two. Except at this point, with the way she was feeling, Sandy wasn't sure she could trust herself. Just in case, she should keep only a few and get rid of the rest. She cracked open the bottles and dumped the contents of both together into her palm. When Sandy looked, there were a few different shaped pills and a silver chain, broken at the clasp, with a silver moon charm, an aquamarine stone set inside. It was Jenna's necklace. The one she always had on. The one that meant so much to her, though even Sandy didn't know why. Because for all the many secrets that Jenna wouldn't keep from her daughter, about the drugs she took and the men she slept with, who gave her that necklace was the one thing she refused to tell. It was dark by the time Sandy got on her bike. Her hands were trembling against the handlebars and her heart was pounding. There was no good reason for Jenna's necklace to be in one of those bottles. There was only one bad reason for Jenna and her necklace to be separated in the first place. Jenna was dead. How the necklace had ended up in Hannah's house in a goddamn old pill bottle, Sandy didn't have a clue. Had Steve taken the pills off Jenna? No, they had his or his wife's name on them. None of it made any sense. Not good sense, anyway. It wasn't until Sandy was pulling out of the parking lot that she noticed the police car parked across the street from Richdale Commons. Don't look guilty. Don't give them a reason. All Sandy had to do was keep going, real easy, like she wasn't worried about a damn thing. Like all teenagers in Ridgedale rode their bikes around in the dark. As Sandy passed the patrol car, she lifted her eyes just a little above her arm. Could have been anyone in that police car, sitting there for lots of reasons. Except once she got a better look, she saw that it wasn't just anyone. It was Hannah's dad, Steve. The same guy who seemed to know all about Jenna the second Sandy mentioned her name. The guy who had Jenna's most prized possession in his medicine cabinet. Hannah's dad was that guy. And right now, that guy was staring dead at Sandy. Like the person he was really looking for was her.
Molly. June 2nd, 2013. Justin made it to the final round for the job at Ridgedale University. He's so excited, and I really am happy for him. He gave up so much in the past year and a half to take care of us. In a weird way, the whole terrible thing brought us so much closer. And it's definitely his turn. I want us to focus on him and what he needs for a while. But it's so hard to think of leaving. And I know she never even lived in our apartment. But she died here. Inside me. As I slept. As I walked. As I breathed. What will become of her if we leave this place behind? Ridgedale Reader. Online edition. March 18th, 2015. 5:23 p.m. News alert. Police schedule community meeting by Molly Sanderson. The Ridgedale Police Department will hold a community meeting this evening at 7 p.m. at the Ridgedale University Athletic Center. The meeting will provide an update on the investigation of the deceased infant found near the Essex Bridge. Topics to be discussed will include the department's planned voluntary DNA testing. The meeting is open to the public. A question and answer session will follow a brief presentation. Molly. When I got to Winchester's pub, Justin was sitting in one of the worn wooden booths near the front, the ones with the initials of university students from decades long past carved into the now polished surfaces. With his scruffy face and beat-up jeans, Justin could have passed for a good-looking graduate student, if there hadn't been two actual students with him, a boy with bad acne and a huge Adam's apple, and a girl with a pixie face and spiky black hair with green tips, both of whom looked about 12 by comparison. When I texted him, he'd said he was back from the conference, grabbing dinner with some advisees if I wanted to come by. And I did. I needed to see him. I'd felt shaken ever since I'd left Harold's house with that bracelet in my pocket, turned over in exchange for an old box of CDs I happened to have in my trunk. Speaking to Steve afterward hadn't helped either. I called him as soon as I'd driven a safe distance from Harold's and pulled into an empty driveway. "I think you should consider speaking again with the man who lives across the street from where you found the baby," I'd said, trying not to sound pushy or judgmental. I think he may have seen something the night the baby was left.
Harold told you that, did he?
Steve had taken a loud breath.
Did he also tell you that he's a convicted felon? Aggravated assault? With a history of mental illness and a record of filing false reports?
No, I'd said, feeling reprimanded and embarrassed again. He didn't mention that.
My personal advice is to steer clear of Harold, Steve had said. Nothing you'll get from him could possibly be worth the risk of sticking around long enough to find it out.
Justin grinned and waved when he saw me. I was about to head over when my phone rang. I paused on the side of the bar. Richard Englander. I dropped my phone right back into my pocket and let the call go to voicemail again. I'd gotten several more texts from Eric, including one praising my essay about infanticide, but none had said a word about Richard. Eric was due back in a day or so, he'd said. If Richard had an issue with my being on the story, he'd have to take it up with Eric when he got back.
"Guys, this is my wife Molly,"
Justin said when I'd made my way over to their table, which was covered with half-empty plates and glasses. They'd long since finished eating.
"Tamara and Jeff are in my 19th-century fiction class. They were just telling me that the Dean of Students has shot down the Animal Rights Committee's plan to lock themselves in cages in the middle of the Quad to protest factory farming."
"Factory farming is totally disgusting," the girl said, glaring at me as if I had a bunch of baby cows jammed in cages in my backyard. "Yes," I said, because I was kind of scared to disagree. "Absolutely awful."
"I promise I will do what I can to help plead your case, but I'm afraid right now I'm on borrowed time with the wife," Justin said, winking at me. "Can we pick this up later, guys?"
"Yeah, sure," the boy said, grabbing his stuff and digging in his pockets for cash.
"No, no, Jeff," Justin said. "It's on me." "Thanks, Professor Sanderson."
Jeff elbowed the girl.
"Come on, Tam."
The girl was still squinting at me.
"Tamara, we'll work it out," Justin said. "Don't worry."
"Okay, Mr. Sanderson," she said before pouting out the door. "Wow, she's quite the ray of sunshine," I muttered.
"Hubris of youth."
Justin shrugged, watching them go.
"Someone needs to keep on fighting the good fight now that we're too old and decrepit to care about anything but getting a good night's sleep."
"They're what, freshmen? They look like babies."
"That's because they are babies. They're extension students from Ridgedale High School, juniors and seniors."
His brow wrinkled.
"Speaking of which, I'm pretty sure they aren't supposed to be joining the clubs, much less protesting anything on campus. But I may let Thomas Price handle that. He supervises the high school exchange program. Anyway, they're good kids. The boy is really sharp, more insightful than a lot of the actual freshmen."
"And the girl?"
"Not so much. Being angry may be taking up a lot of her mental energy," Justin said, which made me laugh.
"Well, if she's pissed about factory farming, her head is going to burst when she hears about the police department's DNA dragnet." Steve had briefly mentioned the planned community-wide voluntary DNA testing when we spoke about Harold. He'd asked me to post an alert about the community meeting, where he would be making the official announcement.
"Dragnet? That sounds daunting,"
Justin said as I sat across from him and started picking at his leftover French fries. "I think it might be," I said. "Can you get Ella on your way home? She's at Mia's house having dinner."
"Sure," Justin said. "Everything okay?"
"I just need to cover the community meeting so I can be there to record the town's collective conniption when the police announce this thing."
"In their defense, it doesn't sound very constitutional," he said. "Oh, and by the way,"
he pulled out his phone and showed me the text I had sent earlier.
"What is this? It looks like an address."
He could tell it wasn't innocuous, wasn't a mistake, and it didn't seem wise to lie. If I wanted him to trust me, I needed to be trustworthy. "I had to do an interview." I shrugged. "The guy made me nervous. It seemed best if someone knew where I was, just in case."
"Just in case?" His eyes were wide. Excess of caution. Isn't that what you wanted? Hmm. He was trying not to argue. Neither one of us wanted to go back down the bumpy road we'd traveled the night before. I felt the slip of paper in my coat pocket, then, the one I'd found there that morning. Though this one was hardly a slip. Nearly half a page, it was folded into a square. I pulled it out. This one is one of my favorites. I know, Justin said. I remember. And this is the wonder that's keeping the stars apart. I carry your heart. I carry it in my heart. E.E. Cummings. The waitress came and handed Justin the check. He pulled out some cash and tucked it into the hard leather check holder. Wait, you're not going to help publicize their fascist dragnet, are you? Justin said, looking suddenly aggravated, as though the thought had just occurred to him. I can't believe you'd be okay with something like that. It goes against everything you've always believed in. Regardless of how old and decrepit he liked to proclaim himself, he could get pretty wound up about social justice. I'm reporting on its existence, not endorsing it, I said, feeling defensive. Justin was probably taking this as yet another sign of my fundamental instability. Besides, I think they're hoping that they won't have to go through with it, that the threat will be enough to make someone come forward. And in the meantime, they want to use you as their propaganda machine? Justin asked, as if it were some kind of personal affront. I'm not trying to be an asshole, Molly. And I heard you last night about needing to stay on this story, loud and clear. I just don't want to see you get used in the process. I hate to say it, but you might be a bit of an easy mark. Well, gee, thanks for that, I said, but mildly. He was agreeing to drop his objections to my staying on the story. I had to be grateful for that and take the passive-aggressive swipe. You're all about the compliments these days. I'm sorry, he said. I tried not to notice how sad he seemed. I'm trying to look out for you, that's all. I know. I put a hand on his face. Maybe look out for me a little less, okay? Are you sure? He smiled. He seemed melancholy still, but less so. Because I'm so good at it. Yeah, except, lucky for us. I smoothed my thumb over his cheek. You're good at lots of things. Halfway to the athletic center, I realized I should have driven and parked in the gym's easily accessible and brightly lit parking lot. I hadn't really been thinking when I'd parted ways with Justin on the green. It was night, but unusually warm, and I'd figured the walk would do me good. So I'd left my car parked on Franklin Avenue and blithely strode headlong onto campus. It hadn't occurred to me, though, how empty and how dark it would be. The dorms and student center were all in the opposite direction, and so, it seemed, were all the people. The language lab, the art studio, and the theater were bright but a distance away, and the largest academic buildings, Rockland Hall, Barry Hall, and Sampson Hall, were all pitch black at that hour. The deeper I went into the darkness, the more nervous I became, so that by the time I was halfway across campus, even the sound of my own heels on the path, loud and echoing, was making me jittery. I texted Justin as I walked. Please tell me campus is safer than it feels. I held the phone in my hand, waiting for him to respond. But he was probably inside Mia's house getting Ella, his phone left behind in the car's cup holder. I walked faster, feeling even more vulnerable with the unanswered text in my hand. I checked over my shoulder to be sure that no one was following me. When that didn't make me feel any better, I did it again and again, until I was doing it every couple steps, feeling more wound up with each swivel of my head. There was no one behind me, at least no one I could see, and yet it felt like someone was there, as I followed the path down the hill toward the athletic center and through a short tunnel of trees.
I was relieved when the sidewalk rose on the other side. The athletic center in sight lit up a welcoming gold. There was a small crowd clustered near the door. Probably not close enough to hear me if I called out, so I picked up the pace, my heels louder as I headed across the last stretch of concrete. I was about to step onto the tail end of the sidewalk hugging the circular drive, when there was a noise to my left. Something in the darkness. The wind, hopefully. That was my best-case scenario. I was looking in the direction of the sound when I bumped right into something. Someone. My phone slipped out of my hands and cracked to the ground.
"Oops,"
Deckler said, as though I were so silly for throwing my phone around. He bent to pick it up, inspecting it, then wiped the screen over his sleeve before handing it back to me.
"Good as new."
He was out of his snug yellow and black campus safety bicycle uniform, but was even less appealing in his sweatshirt and jeans. Why was he always everywhere, watching me? The files. A campus security officer would have had plenty of access to each and every one of those girls. And the power to bury complaints. Not to mention Deckler's menacing vibe and his apparent willingness to startle a woman walking alone in the dark. He didn't maintain appropriate boundaries, at least not with women. He knew I had those files, and he wasn't happy about it. I was convinced of it. He was hanging around, waiting to see what I was going to do about them, and then, if necessary, he would pounce. "Thanks," I said, taking my phone back. Had he somehow come from the left, where I'd heard that noise? "Are you here for the meeting?"
"Nah," he said with unsettling vagueness. "Just checking things out."
"Okay, well, great." I smiled, no doubt unconvincingly.
"I should probably get going. Someone's saving a seat for me inside."
Deckler needed to know I was meeting someone, that I would be missed, even if it wasn't true. I expected to see Stella, but we'd made no plans to meet.
"By the way, did you get what you needed on that student?"
he asked, looking off into the distance like he was, you know, just curious.
"Rose, was it?"
Except I hadn't told Deckler that.
"Yes, I did."
I smiled, backing toward the building and out of Deckler's reach. "I have all the information I need now.
Let me know if there's anything else I can do to help."
His voice was flat and affectless. It made the hairs on my arms stand on end. "I will, definitely. Bye." I spun on a heel and raced for the building without looking back, bracing myself for Deckler to grab me. When I dove inside unimpeded, my heart was drumming against my ribcage. Steve was at a podium in the center of the gym floor. Next to him were Ben LaFord and Thomas Price, who kept checking his big watch like he had some place he would much rather be. Anywhere else, probably. It was hard to blame him. It had been savvy PR, though, for the university to host the community meeting. Thomas Price's idea, I suspected. Instead of distancing itself from the baby's death, the university was letting itself be drawn further into the fray. Only an institution convinced of its innocence would do such a thing. But after my run-in with Deckler, I thought that confidence seemed woefully misplaced. The meeting had gotten quite a turnout. People filled the bleachers on both sides. Folding chairs had been set up at each end. Many more were standing.
"I'm Ridgedale Chief of Police, Steve Carlson. Thank you all for coming."
It wasn't until then that I noticed the flyers making their way noisily around the room.
"The purpose of this meeting is to update you on the status of our investigation into the death of an approximately newborn female infant found Tuesday morning near the Essex Bridge. There will be an opportunity for questions after a brief announcement. The infant remains unidentified, and we are still awaiting an official cause of death from the medical examiner. We do not believe this death is related to any other death.
That was in response to my story about Simon Barton, but I stood by its newsworthiness. Anything that serendipitous was worth investigating, even if all I had was hysterical Harold as proof.
We are proceeding with an innovative program of voluntary DNA testing that we hope will expedite the identification of the baby.
Well, that was carefully worded, as though the baby would be identified by the DNA samples of good, innocent people. In reality, the only person whose test results would matter would be the guilty party.
As discussed in the flyers being distributed to you now, the test is painless and quick, takes less than 5 minutes. Non-matching DNA samples will be discarded immediately and confidentially. To reiterate, they will not be kept in any kind of database. Details of where and when the DNA collections will take place are on the handout. We hope that you will all consider lending your help.
There was rustling as people took the sheets, then a long pause as they read, probably having a hard time, like I was, digesting it. Especially galling was the fact that high school and college students were clearly intended to be included in the sweep of all Ridgedale residents age 12 and over. An asterisk provided that minors would be tested only in the presence of and with consent from their parents or guardians. A moment later, a bunch of hands shot up, and so did the amount of noise. People's faces had darkened, along with the mood.
"You there," Steve said, pointing at a squat man on the right side of the bleachers in an expensive-looking pumpkin-colored sweater.
He was in his late 40s with thinning hair. By the time he stood, the sound had grown to a roar.
"Excuse me, please,"
shouted Thomas Price, an unexpected savior, but probably the only possible one.
"We'll all have to be quiet if anyone is going to hear."
Watching Price, I could see why the university had appointed him its unofficial spokesman. Calm, authoritative, appealing. As a bonus, they could always claim he wasn't an official university spokesman if things went badly. The volume dutifully dropped.
"Thank you, everyone. Now, go ahead with your question, sir." "There are about 1,000 ways a DNA sweep is one of the worst ideas I've ever heard."
The squat man looked wide-eyed around the crowd.
"No one is going to consent. You know that, right? At least they shouldn't. Trust me, I'm a lawyer. Don't do it. At least talk to your own lawyer first. You'd be forfeiting your constitutional rights. Just because they're saying they won't keep the samples, there's nothing to stop them."
He nodded back at Steve.
"No offense. I'm not saying you personally. I mean in general."
Steve glared at the man until he sat back down. Then he stayed quiet, eyes moving slowly over the crowd, letting the silence grow uncomfortable.
"No offense taken," Steve said finally, working his jaw to the side. "And to be clear, you are all absolutely free to consult your attorneys or your accountants or your spiritual advisors before deciding whether or not to help. You can look inside yourselves and decide that having a Q-tip wiped across the inside of your cheek or your kid's cheek is wrong on principle. It's a free country, and that's the meaning of voluntary. You get to choose."
The crowd was utterly still now.
"But I would say this. When we found the baby, floating in a creek like a piece of trash, she was stuck there, her neck hung up on a stick. I pulled her out myself. Weighed almost nothing."
He was quiet again, this time like he was trying to gather his composure.
"Principles are a luxury that baby's never going to have."
It was good theater. Impassioned, persuasive, and genuine. Steve obviously believed what he was saying. Of course, that didn't make it true. The dragnet did sound unconstitutional, or at least potentially so.
Nonetheless, Steve's speech had, as intended, succeeded in silencing public opposition. For an hour and a half afterward, people steered clear of queries about the DNA sweep. Instead, someone wanted to know more about Simon Barton. As he had with me, Steve dismissed the connection out of hand. Others wanted to know about some men on a local sex offender registry. Someone else agitated for precautionary fingerprinting in the schools, and another for an investigative neighborhood watch, focusing, it seemed, largely on Ridgedale Commons, the apartment complex that was the town's de facto low-income housing. Thankfully, several others dismissed that idea as appallingly discriminatory. Steve brought the hammer down on it anyway. Dangerous and irresponsible vigilantism, he called it. And not long after that, he called stop to all of it.
Looks like we'll have to wrap this up for now.
Steve's voice was hoarse from all the talking, as he pointed to a huge clock high on the wall.
University was kind enough to let us use their facilities, but I did promise we'd be cleared out by 9 p.m., and we've already gone 20 minutes past that.
There was some displeased grumbling as people stood and slowly began to disperse. Some didn't get very far, settling into large pods dotted across the gym floor, presumably to exchange theories and complaints. Others shuffled toward the doors. I turned to make my way over to Stella, whom I'd spotted in the distance, embedded with a group of high school moms and dads. I was hoping she'd give me a ride to my car. I wasn't going to cross back over that dark campus alone, not with Deckler lurking out there. Stella, I called, as she and her group started to drift toward the door. She kept on chatting with a mother as she walked on. She hadn't heard me. A second later, she had disappeared, lost to the crowd.
Molly Sanderson, someone said then. Nice to see a friendly face.
I was relieved to see Thomas Price walking toward me, with a hand clasped around the back of his neck. He looked absolutely exhausted. Oh, hi, I said, wondering how I could ask Price to walk me to my car without seeming needy or ridiculous. How are you?
I've been better.
He motioned to the dispersing throng.
I wish the university president were here to see this, all these people. Maybe then he'd understand that this isn't going anywhere anytime soon.
Price shook his head.
Anyway, other than that, I am very well, thank you. Yourself?
Okay. But can I ask you a question?
For you, anything, Price said, then glanced away as though he'd inadvertently shown his hand.
But when he met my eyes a second later, his expression was so guileless I wondered if I'd imagined it.
However, do consider yourself forewarned. My actual answers seem in maddeningly short supply today.
I ran into one of the campus safety officers on my way here. Officer Deckler? How to accuse Deckler of sexual assault without accusing him, that was the question. Because not even Rose had put it in such distinct terms, and the files weren't proof of anything in and of themselves. They were merely a compelling clue. A strong opening salvo. My strongest evidence was my overwhelming instinctual suspicion, exacerbated by Deckler's incessant creepiness. Hardly incontrovertible either. Deckler seemed overly interested in my conversation with you about Rose Gowan, and the status of my investigation in general. Do you know why that might be?
Wait, Deckler was on campus tonight?
Thomas Price looked uncharacteristically alarmed.
Where did you see him?
Outside the athletic center? Walking on the path toward the main campus? My stomach tightened. I had been so sure Price would tell me what a great guy Deckler was. He wasn't in uniform. I don't think he was on duty.
No, he wouldn't have been.
Thomas Price was looking toward the doors, as though making some kind of calculation.
Deckler was suspended earlier today. He was also barred from campus, pending an investigation, which means he shouldn't have been here at all.
Deckler hadn't been off duty. He was off the job.
What is he being investigated for? Let's just say overzealousness.
Price shook his head and exhaled, among others.